From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember the lyricist who put the rainbow in The Wizard of Oz, Yip Harburg. In addition to the songs from The Wizard of Oz, he wrote the lyrics for It's Only a Paper Moon, Old Devil Moon, April in Paris, and Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? We'll hear from Harburg's son, Ernie Harburg, and music theater scholar Dina Rosenberg, who has been married to Ernie Harburg for 17 years. They've collaborated on a review of Harburg's songs. Also, we talk with director, actor, and writer Paul Mazursky. His films include Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Next Stop Greenwich Village, and An Unmarried Woman. He's written a new memoir about making movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Talks between the U.S. and Russia have adjourned for the night and are expected to resume in the morning. Top officials from the two countries have spent 2 days trying to determine what role Russian peacekeepers will play in Kosovo. Moscow wants its troops to have their own sector to patrol. Meanwhile, the stream of refugees back into Kosovo continues, and many of the ethnic Albanians are returning to the charred remains of their homes and shops and to stories about loved ones who have been killed. NPR Sarah Chase reports from Jakovica.
This town in western Kosovo looks like World War II. In one neighborhood of what used to be quaint wood-fronted shops, nothing remains but blackened wreckage. From the houses behind, residents emerge with photographs and tears and tell of a massacre that took place on May 7th. There was fighting between the Kosovo Liberation Army and the Serbs, they say. They left their houses, but Serbian special police pulled the men aside on a bridge. Relatives say they were split into two groups and shot. In the surrounding countryside, villagers use a tractor-drawn plow to dig up a suspicious mound of earth where Serbs had a roadblock the same day. Tractors, which have become the symbol of this war, see service again. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Jakovica.
Attorney General Janet Reno paid a visit to Capitol Hill this afternoon to help Democrats rally support for stronger gun control proposals. Democrats say the plan backed by most Republicans is a step backward. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more.
Flanked by House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt and New York Democrat Carolyn McCarthy, Reno said she was here to help bolster support for gun measures as strong as those passed in the Senate. McCarthy said much of the job involved explaining to members what the problems are with the weaker amendment backed by Michigan Democrat John Dingell. Reno agreed.
I'm doing everything I can in these hours to make sure that the message is heard, that we are only trying to make sure that people who should not have guns under the law don't get them.
The NRA issued a letter strongly backing the Dingell proposal for 24-hour background checks at gun shows with at least 10 vendors. McCarthy calls that a throwback. The House has also backed an amendment requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in schools and other state-owned buildings. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
About 45 Democrats joined with most Republicans to approve that measure to allow states to determine whether to permit the display of the Ten Commandments in schools and other government buildings. Opponents say it violates the separation of church and state, but supporters say it will help improve the moral character of the nation. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 56.5 points. It ended the day at 10,841. Trading was moderate, 695 million shares changed hands. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. The Vietnam War crypt at the Tomb of the Unknowns will remain empty for now. The Pentagon says that scientific techniques are so advanced that there are no unidentified remains from the war. The crypt has remained empty since last May, when the body of Air Force Lieutenant Michael Blassie was removed. Crews at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, have begun moving the nation's tallest lighthouse. The 129-year-old beacon is being relocated about a half mile inland to protect it from erosion. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
At 208 feet, the Cape Hatteras Lighthouse is the tallest masonry structure ever to be moved. Workers are using a hydraulic system to slide the tower down a metal track so slowly that it's difficult to see the movement. In the first stage of the 6-week operation, the lighthouse traveled only 5 inches. But to Bob Reynolds of the National Park Service, it was cause for celebration.
It is a major milestone in this project, this preserving a piece of America's heritage. And that's, I mean, that's what those of us in the Park Service dedicate our lives and our career to.
The black and white striped lighthouse is a National Historic Landmark and is among the most visited tourist attractions on the East Coast. But beach erosion has been so severe, the Park Service said the lighthouse had to be moved to keep it from falling into the sea. Adam Hochberg, NPR News, Cape Hatteras, North Carolina.
The airline industry has announced a package of voluntary measures to address growing complaints from consumers about poor service. They're designed to keep Congress from passing stronger consumer protection laws. The measures include such things as ensuring that each airline will inform customers of the lowest possible fare. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? It's Only a Paper Moon, Old Devil Moon, April in Paris, How Are Things in Glaucomora, Last Night When We Were Young, and all the songs from The Wizard of Oz have lyrics by Yip Harburg. His longest collaboration was with composer Harold Arlen.
Hello, Mr. Harburg. Hello, Mr. Arlen.
Hello, Judy. We've been waiting for you.
Judy, we've just finished writing one of the songs you're to sing in The Wizard of Oz, and no one's heard it yet, so we've got our fingers crossed.
Oh, I can hardly wait. Will you teach it to me, please? Now?
My guests are Ernie Harburg, who co-wrote a book about his father, Yip, and music theater scholar Dina Rosenberg, who worked closely with Yip Harburg in the decade before his death in 1981. Ernie Harburg and Dina Rosenberg have been married for 17 years. They've collaborated on a review of Yip Harburg's songs, which is currently being performed at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. Harburg was born in 1896, the son of poor Russian immigrants living in New York. In junior high school, he became good friends with a soon-to-be great lyricist, Ira Gershwin. In an interview that Dina Rosenberg conducted with Yip Harburg, she asked how Ira helped Yip get into songwriting.
He didn't get me into songwriting. What got me into songwriting was the capitalist system. I went into business after school because I didn't think you could make money at versifying. I sold poems. And I'd get $10 or $15. Well, how could you live on that? So I went into business. I had to support my mother and father. And the business started becoming very affluent. We were making, it looked as if I was going to be a very successful businessman. But I never stopped contributing to the different columns in the different newspapers so that while I was at business, this was really my love. And I thought I'd be able to sell the business in another few years and become a writer. But heaven was ahead of me, and that beautiful depression, 1929, came along, knocked the hell out of my business, put me in debt, and I immediately got a hold of Ira and said, Ira, I said, I think I'd like to be a songwriter from here on. I'm through with business. And he said, you should have done it a long time ago. But I was fearful. And he introduced me to Jay Gorney. Mm-hmm. And Jay Gorney at that time was writing with Howard Dietz, and they broke up. And I began writing with Jay. And it was quite a hard job making a transition from light verse writing to lyric writing, because there's a vast difference. The difference between a lyric and a poem is a histrionic quality that a lyric has that a poem does not have to have. A poem is intellectual, a lyric is emotional and dramatic.
That's Yip Harburg in an interview recorded in 1979 with my guest Dina Rosenberg. And she co-wrote a new review of Harburg's songs, which is now at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. Also with us is Ernie Harburg, who's the president of the Harburg Foundation. He's Yip Harburg's son. He's a research scientist who also co-wrote a biography of his father. Well, so we just found out about how Ira Gershwin really played a significant role in getting Yip Harburg started as a lyricist, and even introduced him to Jay Gorney, who was the first major composer that Harburg collaborated with, and their really big hit together was Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Mm-hmm. And Ernie Harburg, I'm going to ask you, you know, in your biography of your father, you write how the song Brother, Can You Spare a Dime started off as a different lyric. I mean, when Harburg met Gorney, Gorney presented him this song that already had a lyric. Would you read us what the original lyric was?
Yeah. What happened was that there was a review called Americana devoted to what they called The Forgotten Man. And it was about the Depression. And the money was instantly gone and the show was going under in rehearsal. And Yip wanted this show. He went to Schubert. And he said, look, I'll get in some composers, and I'll put this show together for you, all right? And so he called in young Harold Arlen, young Burton Lane, young Sammy Fain, Johnny Green to help him with the lyrics. And then he asked each of the composers to play him some tunes, which they all had in what they call the trunk, you know, the ones that never got out. And when Jay's turn came, Jay played him several songs, and he heard this one song, which Jay sang, and I'm quoting from the book here, I could go on crying big blue tears ever since you said we were through. I could go on crying big blue tears, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, whatever. It was a torch song, and that was what the dominant song was at that time. And Yip listened carefully, heard the tune, the music, and said to Jay, could we take out the lyrics? I think we can do something else with that. And then it was supposed to be a satire in a comedic setting in a review. And at that time, Rockefeller used to go around giving dimes to kids on the street. And Yip had this funny line about sharing a dime between Rockefeller and the kid. But then in the writing of it, all of Yip's political, social philosophy started coming out, that Yip was a socialist at the time, and he was very, very deeply concerned about the working guy. And it started getting serious and developed into the great lyric for Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
I think one of the reasons it got serious, too, besides, of course, the fact that Yip had all this history to him in terms of his own poverty and his own beliefs, was that that melody was a melody in a minor key, a sadder kind of a key, and that the musical ear that Yip had heard something that composers over centuries had heard. In when you put that minor scale going upwards, it kind of resounds in our Western music ears anyway, to be a kind of a melancholy and a poignant resonance. It's not a torch song, a lighter song, a love song, whatever. So there was some incongruence, a deep incongruence he heard between that original lyric and that music. So I think that the music was an inspiration, as well as the fact that Yip wanted to write a different kind of a lyric to the song.
Why don't we hear the hit version from 1932, recorded by Bing Crosby. This is Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, lyric by Yip Harburg, music by Jay Gorney.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
It's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, with a lyric by Yip Harburg, music by Jay Gorney, recorded in 1932 by Bing Crosby. Well, that was the first of many socially conscious types of songs that Yip Harburg wrote. Why was he so into the socially conscious song?
Yip was born into extremely dire poverty on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. He saw so much, even within his own family setting, much less on the street and in the whole context, but had several siblings die in childbirth, had to sleep on a chair or on the floor, you know, with the remaining siblings and so on, and was always without heat, without light, and all of that. That he had it in his bones that there had to be a better way. And as he grew up and was educated, and there were wonderful things about America, like libraries that he discovered, and friends like Ira Gershwin, the Gershwin family, and so on. And in Brother, Can You Spare a Dime, there's a question, or a lot of questions, actually, and Yip's songs are noted for questions. You know, the title is Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And the last line of the verse of the song, Why Should I Be Standing in Line, Just Waiting for Bread? It's a question, and so it's sort of a paradoxical thing. Here's a land of plenty. Here's a place where there should be work. There should be a situation. It should be better, and yet that's not happening. And so it's a kind of a wanting to get people to understand that there is this paradox and perhaps move them to action. He was a writer who wanted to, through song, move people to action.
We'll talk more about lyricist Yip Harburg after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the lyrics of Yip Harburg, which are being celebrated now in a show in Philadelphia, which is called Over the Rainbow, and it's at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. My guest, Dina Rosenberg, co-wrote the show. Ernie Harburg, my other guest, is Yip's son and co-wrote a biography of his father. And Dina Rosenberg and Ernie Harburg are married. The longest and, I think, most productive collaboration that Yip Harburg had was with Harold Arlen. And among their many collaborations were the songs for The Wizard of Oz. What was Yip Harburg's role in The Wizard of Oz besides working on the lyrics? Because he did more than that.
Yes, he did a lot more. And I would sum it up by saying that at first he conceived the idea of integrating the songs and the dances, he wrote all the setups or dialogue leading into the songs during that period, and then he wrote the whole section at the end where the wizard gives out the heart, the brain, the nerve, and finally he was the final editor, in which he put the whole thing together in a way that he was eminently gifted for, because he'd done that with Broadway shows as a show doctor on Broadway.
So Yip Harburg pushed to have the songs tell the story,
yes,
and not just be added on to the story.
Exactly.
And the place where the songs tell the story, that's the most striking example in The Wizard of Oz, is the Munchkin Land sequence, where the house lands in Munchkin Land. And you've had Somewhere Over the Rainbow, of course, the great song, but basically you've been in a black and white world where there isn't color and much music in the little girl's life. Once you get to Munchkin Land, you've got music all the way through it, weaving in and out of the whole story of what happened to that witch, and the good witch comes and the bad witch died, and you
ding
have to
dong,
go,
the witch is dead.
And you've got to go off to see the wizard and follow the yellow brick road and that whole business. And in a way, you could think of it that, you know, people credit rightly Oklahoma for setting a new trend in the Broadway musical in terms of the integration of elements. But here you have a film musical which is really integrating elements in a similar kind of way that was several years Oklahoma's predecessor.
The characters of the Cowardly Lion and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow are told through song. The characters are described through their songs, and the lyrics are wonderful for those three songs. Why don't we listen to Yip Harburg himself singing the lyrics he wrote to introduce those characters. This is from The Wizard of Oz.
I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain. And my thoughts I'd be hatching while my head was busy scratching, if I only had a brain. I'd unravel any riddle for any individual in trouble or in pain. And perhaps I'd deserve you and be even worthier of you if I only had a brain. When a man's an empty kettle, he should be on his mettle, and yet I'm torn apart. Just because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart. Life is sad, believe me, missy, when you're born to be a sissy without the vim and verb. But I could show my prowess, be a lion, not a mouse, if I only had the nerve.
That's Yip Harburg from a CD called Yip Sings Harburg. I think probably the most famous song from The Wizard of Oz is Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is the title of your show paying tribute to the lyrics of Yip Harburg. And there's a great story, Ernie Harburg, that you tell in your biography of your father about how Yip Harburg suggested the idea of a rainbow to Harold Arlen before Harold Arlen actually wrote the melody for the song. So talk to us a little bit about the origins of the song Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
What made your father think that a rainbow should be in this song in the first place? Because
yeah,
it's not mentioned, I believe, in the book.
Right. In L. Frank Baum's book, in the first paragraph, he describes a landscape in Kansas which has no color. It's all black and white and gray and dim, and Dorothy resides there. She's an orphan, apparently, and she has this yearning to grow and live in other places, and she's had in trouble there. And then Yip conceived the idea of a rainbow that she could think about, and Yip had the idea about, I want to get to the other side of the rainbow. And that's what he told Harold.
So what did Yip Harburg think of the melody when Harold Arlen gave him the melody and said, now you can write the lyric?
Well, Harold was a wonderful piano player, but Harold played it in this symphonic way. And Yip listened to it, and he said, Harold, that sounds like Nelson Eddy, you know, an operatic kind of thing. He said, that's not for a little girl on Kansas. Why don't you keep working on it? And he went away. And 2 weeks later, Harold called him and said, Yip, you have to come over. This is the music for what we need. I know it. And Yip always respects when a composer says that, so he came over again, listened to it, and he was still dubious. So at that time, there was a wonderful community, which Dina writes about in her book on collaboration of George and Ira Gershwin. All of these songwriters would meet at the Gershwin House, for instance, have a salon. They'd play their songs for each other. So it was just natural for them to call Ira to come over and say, Ira, listen to this. We've got a little difference. And Ira listened. And he said, Harold, why don't you just play it in a more simple kind of melody in a more popular way? Or maybe Dina can describe the musical words.
Well, he said, Ira said, just play the melodic line, the melody, what someone would sing, very simply. And when that other stuff was taken away, Yip could hear that this could be the voice of a child, of a young girl. And he said, oh, yes, now I can hear it.
Dina Rosenberg and Ernie Harburg will be back in the second half of the show to talk more about the lyrics of Yip Harburg. The review of his songs is at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Away above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me. Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly. Birds fly over the rainbow.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Bantam Books, publishers of The Scalpel and The Silver Bear, a memoir by the first Navajo woman surgeon, Dr. Lori Arviso Alvord, about her efforts to combine Western medicine and traditional healing. Available in hardcover. From Time Magazine, this week, Time begins its 2000 presidential election coverage by interviewing Texas Governor George W. Bush and his wife, Laura. And from Bantam Books, publisher of O Jerusalem by Laurie R. King, a novel of suspense featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes, available in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the life and lyrics of Yip Harburg. And we talk with Paul Mazursky, the director of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Next Stop Greenwich Village, An Unmarried Woman, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Mazursky has written a memoir about making movies.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about lyricist Yip Harburg. He wrote the lyrics to Brother Can You Spare a Dime, Old Devil Moon, and April in Paris. He collaborated with Harold Arlen on the songs for The Wizard of Oz. A review of Harburg's songs is being performed at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. My guests are his son, Ernie Harburg, and theater music scholar Dina Rosenberg. She and Ernie Harburg have been married for 17 years. Harold Arlen told John Lahr, now the theater critic for The New Yorker, and the son of Bert Lahr, who was in The Wizard of Oz, Arlen told him that Yip Harburg was not a blues thinker. He said he likes things to be joyous and or poetic. And in that respect, I think Arlen and Harburg were a strange match. Was it a comfortable relationship for them? What was their working relationship like?
As far as I understand it from talking to Yip, they had a wonderful working relationship. There was something maybe about, I don't know if it's opposites attract or if it's something they could hear in each other's things which made a three-dimensionality to the characters. In other words, that in order to get a character to come alive, you need the various dimensions. You need the part that's got the joyousness, that's got the verbiage that's clever and that is intellectually witty and so on, and you've got a bluesier musical sound that juxtaposes to it. However, an interesting comment in this regard is that when Yip wanted to do maybe his most famous Broadway show, Finian's Rainbow, which is a deeply political show, Harold Arlen didn't want to write that show with him because it was too political for him. And so Yip had to turn to another composer he respected deeply, Burton Lane, who felt as politically strongly as Yip did. And they managed, Yip always used to like to say, they gilded the philosophic pill. They tried not to put, you know, all their attacks on racism and capitalism and so on in too unpalatable a way. But there were cases where Arlen and Harburg could not match up. And in that show, that was a case.
Ernie Harburg, your father, Yip Harburg, wrote something about just the importance of song and how songs move people. And I'd like you to read that for us.
All right. You know, there's really two parts to this. One is what a song is, and the other one is the impact of songs. And what a song is, essentially, according to Yip, is that the magic in song only happens when the words give destination and meaning to the music, and the music gives wings to the words. Together, as a song, they go places you've never been before. The reason is obvious. Words make you think thoughts. Music makes you feel a feeling. But a song makes you feel a thought. That's the great advantage, to feel the thought. And that's why you can teach more through song and you can rouse more through song than all the prose in the world or all the poems. Songs have been the not-so-secret weapon behind every fight for freedom, every struggle against injustice and bigotry. The Marseillaise, the battle hymn of the Republic, We Shall Overcome, and many, many more. Songs are the pulse of a nation's heart, a fever chart of its health. Are we at peace? Are we in trouble? Are we floundering? Do we feel beautiful? Do we feel ugly? Listen to our songs. The lyricist, like any artist, cannot be neutral. He should be committed to the side of humanity. That was Yip's words.
Well, one of the things that Dina Rosenberg and Ernie Harburg, you both have in common is your appreciation of Yip Harburg's songs. Another thing you have in common is that you're married. and I'd be interested in the story of how you met. Now, Dina Rosenberg, I know you were doing a lot of music theater research, and that research included spending a lot of time with Yip Harburg. You did many interviews with him. Did you meet Yip Harburg before meeting your husband?
Yeah, it's an interesting story because I did meet Yip well before I met Ernie, and we were doing projects together. I think he appreciated the fact that someone much younger, what he considered the younger generation, appreciated the older generation of great classic songwriters. And we just worked on all kinds of things, writing projects, performance projects, and so on. And I would meet Ernie in passing at things. We lived in different cities. Ernie was a research scientist, and he was living in Michigan. And I was living in New York and doing research on the West Coast. And then what happened was that Yip, who was an eternal leprechaun, 84 years young when he died, got a little premonition that he might not be immortal. And he started to think about things that he really wanted to have done in his life or see done after he died. And the two people that he talked to about these very important projects were his son, Ernie. And Ernie would come into New York and they would have long talks about certain aspects of things. And I'm very honored to say to myself about other kinds of projects. And so that what happened was that when Yip actually did die, on his way to a production meeting, he never knew what hit him. He just was in a car, was stopped at a traffic light, and he had a massive heart attack and died, and creating, you know, till the moment that he was no longer alive. I went back to his apartment to help his widow with organizing his papers and so on, organizing a tribute in New York. And Ernie came into New York for similar purpose and walked into the apartment and said, "Oh, Dina," he sort of threw his arms around me because Yip had talked about me and we'd met at various functions, but there was nothing really that was bringing us together as a social couple. Ernie had a wife and a family, but unfortunately she was dying of cancer, and so we had this little list from Yip of things we were supposed to work on together. And after the tragedy of Ernie's wife's death, we found that we had fallen in love over these things we were doing together and just who we were. And that's how it happened.
So Yip Harburg's list is what brought you together. It's as if part of his bequeathal was to have you married.
Yeah.
Something like that. It was almost as if he saw it coming.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us and for sharing some stories about Yip Harburg. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
And good luck with the show.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here.
Ernie Harburg is Yip Harburg's son. Dina Rosenberg founded the Music Theater Writing Program at New York University. The Yip Harburg Review is at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. Here's Susanna McCorkle singing Old Devil Moon, music by Burton Lane, lyrics by Yip Harburg.
I look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the sky. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hot to handle. Stars in the night blazing their light can't hold a candle to your razzle dazzle. You've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. Wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna like a loon. It's that old devil moon in your eyes.
Coming up, film director Paul Mazursky. He has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Mazursky had planned on becoming an actor. He got his start playing a major role in Stanley Kubrick's first film, Fear and Desire. But Mazursky became best known for directing such films as Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Next Stop Greenwich Village, Harry and Tonto, An Unmarried Woman, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills. His latest film, made for HBO, starred Stanley Tucci as gossip columnist Walter Winchell. Mazursky has written a new memoir called Show Me the Magic. His descriptions of his mother sound very much like the overbearing, neurotic mother portrayed by Shelley Winters in Mazursky's film Next Stop Greenwich Village. I asked him to describe his mother.
In the book, I call her Gypsy Jean. And amazingly, when Shelley Winters played this mother in Next Stop Greenwich Village, she had an uncanny insight into my mother, who had already died. Shelley asked me, for example, he said, did your mother type? Was she a great typist? I said, oh, how did you know that? She said, I just did. Did she take you to the movies all the time? How did you know? I just did. So Shelley had some great instincts about her, and I loved Shelley and still do, and I thought she did a great job. My mother was a very unique woman. I describe her, as I said, as Gypsy Jean. She was a lower middle class Jewish lady from Brownsville. And she was not whatever cliche you might think that is. She loved opera. She loved great literature. She loved black jazz music. And she loved foreign films. And she took her son, this little boy, me, to all those things. She also was very possessive. I was the only child. And so I had a very up and down relationship with her, Gypsy Jean.
So she took you to the movies a lot. Did you and she respond to different things in the movies?
Well, you know, when I say she took me to the movies, I mean she took me when I was like 7, 8, 9 years old. I would cut school. She said, it's okay. I'll write them a note. You had a cold. And she'd load herself up with candy. She loved to eat candy. And so did I, and so do I. And we'd go to see, Les Enfants du Paradis, up at the Thalia Theater with other great French films, you know, with Gérard Philippe and Louis Jouvet, directed by Jean Renoir and all the greats. And I liked it, but I really didn't know that, oh boy, am I seeing fine art. I was just sort of seeing movies. So our tastes, maybe they were kind of alike, well, you know, but later, when she was alive to see my first two films, the first was Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and they played it at the New York Film, Festival. And I took my mother and, of course, my wife, too, and Mayor Lindsay was there, and Natalie Wood and Elliot, all of them were there, Elliot Gould, Diane Cannon, Bob Culp. And my mother's first lines to me were, don't let it go to your head, big shot. that's the first thing she said. And then when she saw Alex in Wonderland with Donald Sutherland, Jean Moreau, Fellini, and an actress named Viola Spolin played the equivalent of my mother. My mother called me and she said, I saw your picture. It stinks. And I'm suing and I'm going to picket the theater. Why couldn't you get Betty Davis to play me? So my mother was far out. I mean, I got scared. I beg you, Mom, please don't pick it.
What impact did it have on you when she said things like, don't let it go to your head, big shot?
Well, part of me kind of liked it because it was so lacking in sentimentality. But I knew she had a great deal of love for me. And, you know, the overriding emotion I had with my mother, and I'm very frank about this, I was afraid of her.
And you said that she was depressive and that you think her life could have been changed with Prozac. Did her depressions affect you?
Yeah. She'd get very dark, real, real dark. And then she'd get paranoid. And paranoia often, in my humble opinion, Pernhood suspect the truth. You don't want me out here, do you? She would say. I really didn't. So she knew the truth. I'd be ambivalent, at least.
But then you'd have to lie and say, of course I want you here, right?
Well, I would say, yeah, yeah. But she was... It's very hard to totally explain it, but I think you're getting the point.
Now
she was not an easy woman to live with, to be around, but she had a life force and a love for art and beauty that made her very strange and very different.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter, director, and actor Paul Mazursky. He has a new memoir called Show Me the Magic. One of your early roles was in the movie Blackboard Jungle, where Glenn Ford plays a new teacher at a school filled with hoods, and you're one of the hoods. Did you think you looked like a juvenile delinquent when you got the part?
I didn't really, but I try to make it seem so. In order to get the part, I tested for it at MGM in New York. I was living in New York, of course. And, you know, I know how to talk like those guys from Brownsville, you know, and I slicked my hair back and I wore like a club jacket, you know, and every other word was, hey, what are you talking about? Come on, what do you want? And all that stuff, you know, and I got the part. And compared to the L.A. kids who filled out the cast, see, they took from New York, Sidney Poitier, Vic Morrow, Rafael Campos, Danny Terranova, and Paul Mazursky. And we looked pretty tough. The kids, the rest of them looked like surfers, you know. But I got stuck in playing a lot of parts like that, see, which I didn't want to do.
You write in your book that, you know, after you were typecast for a while, as you know, like the hood and stuff, that you were frustrated you never got the kind of roles that Cassavetes, your friend John Cassavetes, got. Mm-hmm. Tough, romantic, leading man, or the young guy with the problems of the world on his existential shoulders. It's funny, compare the kind of roles that you were getting cast with as a very young man with the kind of roles that you've gotten as a mature man. I mean, I think now you're more likely to get cast as the gynecologist.
You saw that.
Yeah, it seems from The Class Struggle.
Yeah. No. Oh,
aren't you a gynecologist in that?
No, I play Jackie Bissett's husband.
But isn't he a gynecologist, or am I remembering wrong?
No, I think he was a furrier. I'm not 100% sure.
Well, furrier, but gynecologist.
Playing Jackie Bissett's husband is, I would do it free. She has purple eyes, the biggest eyes I've ever seen. She's a beautiful woman and very funny, very nice. Well, the parts I was getting were punks, you know, the kind who would be licking an ice cream cone with a knife in one hand, threatening somebody. Hey, yo, wow. I mean, a lot of that, I got bored with it. The parts I get now, well, I'm getting parts of older stuff, you know, guys in their 50s and 60s. And I've had four or five wonderful parts. A few in my own movies, you know, I cast myself. In Enemies of Love Story, I play Leon Tortschiner, who's Lena Olin's husband. And that's a good part. I had a good part in... lately in 2 Days in the Valley, where I play a television director who's living in a lot of failure and decides to kill himself. It's very touching and amusing. But I wasn't getting those parts. Then you see, you get cast mostly for what they think you look like. And since I was in Blackboard Jungle, where I played a tough kid, let's say, I got cast like that.
My guest is Paul Mazursky. He's written a new memoir called Show Me the Magic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back.
My guest is Paul Mazursky. He's best known for directing such films as Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, Harry and Tonto, Next Up Greenwich Village, An Unmarried Woman, and Down and Out in Beverly Hills. One of your early films, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, is about two suburban couples who decide to try switching partners, and they're kind of ambivalent about the whole thing. You say in your book that this was inspired in part by your encounter group sessions at Esalen. Tell me about the connection between the encounter group and the movie.
Well, first let me tell you that I was reading Time magazine in 1968. And there was a picture in Time of a psychologist named Fritz Perls, P-E-R-L-S, and he was sitting in a hot tub with six naked people. And it said a new kind of therapy. So I told my wife, we got to go up and experience this new kind of therapy. Maybe there's a movie in it. And we went up and had a 48-hour sort of encounter, and we took the nude hot tubs, and it was all, you know, very trendy, but felt good. It was a lot of fun for a while, and then in the actual encounters, we were the only couple, and they started to pick on me, on Paul Mazursky. I controlled my wife. I didn't let her breathe. She started to cry, and it got very intense. And out of that, I wrote the opening 20 or 30 pages of Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. And then it's all fiction after that. I changed it to this couple that's experienced this wonderful feeling of elation and freedom and openness, and their best friends who are, you know, squarer and looked down upon and that sort of thing. They tell them the good news that they're so open now that they can handle the fact that Bob has had an affair in San Francisco and Carol is so happy for him. And that creates a situation which eventually builds towards both couples deciding to try to have an orgy.
You write that you've tested the waters of many of the New Age trips and the psychedelics and the gurus and participated in marathon weekends with Sufis, but you still basically distrust it all. Why have you tried so much of that if you basically distrust it?
What a brilliant question. If only I could give you a brilliant Sufi answer. I believe that even if I scoff at stuff, you know, I want to know more about it. What attracts people to it? I've been with a Hopi Indian medicine man. I've taken ayahuasca in the Peruvian jungles. Fantastic. I've had LSD. I have been to synagogues. I've been to Catholic churches. I've had therapy. I had decaf coffee today, which is almost stronger than anything.
You're a little decaf high?
Yeah. I mean, I've been to whirling dervish Sufi things. I've even gone to a few things with the Deepak Chopra type guys and all that stuff. I want to hear it. Mm-hmm. I haven't found an answer yet, nor do I expect to.
You were born with the name Irwin, and you remained Irwin until you made your first film with Stanley Kubrick,
mm-hmm.
The film Fear and Desire, in which you were an actor. What did you want to change your name from Irwin to something else? What did Irwin mean to you?
Well, there was the sound. My mother used to, you know, in Brooklyn in those days, your mother would come out of the apartment and shout down the block, because everything we did was on the block. We played punch ball on the block, tag, ring alivio, whatever games we played. Irwin! Irwin, it's time to eat! And I hated the name Irwin. I couldn't stand it. And I just developed this phobia for Irwin. And as soon as I got to college, I started thinking about, because I was acting in plays in Brooklyn College, maybe I should change it to, my name was Irwin Lawrence Mazursky, to Larry Irwin. I didn't mind Irwin as a last name. or Larry Mazursky. What about Michael Irwin, which I'd actually tried for one play? What about Bart? I thought about Bart, but that's a cowboy name. What about Johnny Bar Mazursky? I just didn't know what to do. And kept being confused by it. Then I got into Stanley Kubrick's picture, Fear and Desire. And my would-be wife called me on the phone. I was working in the Catskills. She says, look, Kubrick is putting finishing touches on the movie, putting in the title cards, do you want to use Irwin Mazursky? I said no. And this, I was at a payphone up in somewhere in the Catskills. And we started pitching names. And I said, and her father's name is Bill Purdy. I said, what about Bill Purdy? She said, what has that got to do with you? And finally, I said, I'm keeping Mazursky. I just made that decision. I'm keeping. And she said, well, what about Paul? I said, Paul Mazursky. And the operator said, your 3 minutes are up. And the line went dead. And that's how I got my name.
It's funny because I think a lot of people would have changed the Mazursky because that's the really ethnic sound.
Well, that's
part.
The joke. You know, mm-hmm. There's the great joke. I don't know what I can say on television. I'll say it. If you don't like it, we'll wipe it out. Is a guy goes up. He says, Judge, my name is Peter Schmuck, and I want to change my name. He said, yes, yeah, so what do you want to call yourself? He says, Jack Schmuck.
Right. Well, did everyone call you Paul after that?
Everyone but my mother.
You remained Irwin.
Irwin!
Yet another reason to keep her off the set, right?
Well, love, hate. Irwin, that's my son, the big shot. You know, his real name is Irwin. Ms. Moreau. She met Jean Moreau. I love your movies. Love them. I loved you in Jules and Jim. I loved you in Fire Down Below, whatever they were called. And this is my son. He calls himself Paul. Big shot.
Paul Mazursky, his new memoir is called Show Me the Magic. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Shurrock. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Majors, In Pursuit of Golf's Holy Grail by NPR contributor John Feinstein, available in hardcover and as a Time Warner audiobook. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores nationwide. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's our weekly archive show, featuring some favorite interviews from the past. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.